Hello, and thank you for joining this Quantum to Cosmos Festival presentation. My name is Daniel Gottesman, and I'm a faculty member here at Perimeter Institute. Welcome to those of you here at Perimeter Institute in Waterloo, Ontario, Canada, and those of you joining us online from around the world. This lecture series is presented by KPMG. We would like to thank KPMG for their generous support of the festival. Before we begin the lecture, I will kindly ask that those of you in the theater turn off your BlackBerries and phones, and those of you at home, please share news of this presentation by emailing the q2cfestival.com link to a friend or colleague. You can also follow us on Twitter. It's now my pleasure to introduce Rob Speckens. Rob is a faculty member at Perimeter Institute. His research is focused on identifying the conceptual innovations that distinguish quantum theories from classical theories and on investigating their consequences for information processing. Today, he is here with us to explore the foundations of quantum theory. Rob?
Thanks very much, Daniel. So given that I'm talking about the foundations of quantum mechanics, I thought I would start by giving you a little bit of a feel for what this field is about. So it turns out quantum theory is an incredibly successful theory. It applies for a broad range of phenomena. We verified it to extremely high accuracy. But despite all that success, there's still no consensus in the scientific community about what this theory is really telling us about the nature of reality. So the field of foundations is trying to understand the theory better, trying to come up with an interpretation of the theory to know what it's really saying. It's also trying to understand what the differences between quantum theories and classical theories are, for example, and what principles underlie quantum theory. Why isn't the world different? Why do we have a quantum world as opposed to some other world? Other motivations for doing foundations are quantum technologies. So if you've been part of the festival, you'll have probably heard a bit about quantum computation and quantum cryptography. And if you have a better understanding of what quantum mechanics is about, you're better able to try to find the new technologies, harness the power of non-classicality. The other motivation is that ultimately we want to move beyond quantum mechanics. We think that probably there'll be some other theory in the future which is different from quantum theory. And we want to know what aspects of quantum theory can we change, can we modify, can we generalize to help us get further. So those are the basic scientific motivations. And if you ask me what are my personal motivations for working in foundations of quantum mechanics, I would say it's because it's so amazingly weird and counterintuitive and mysterious and wonderful. And it's a challenge to try to understand. It really sort of dares you to try to make sense of it. And so I really like that challenge, and that's why I'm in the foundations of quantum mechanics. But it's also very annoying, because it's hard to know what's going on with quantum mechanics. And so I liken it to a Gary Larson cartoon, which I quite like. And so in this cartoon, you have God in his kitchen, and he's got the Earth in the pan in front of him, and he's adding various things to it. So he's got a jar that says animals and another jar that says trees. He's adding all this stuff. And in the caption, he's in the middle of adding jerks. And the thought caption is, just to make things interesting. And it seems to me that that's what quantum mechanics is. Quantum mechanics is like jerks. You know, it makes your life a lot more difficult because it's so hard to understand, but it also makes life very interesting. So I'm hoping that I can communicate some of that interest to you today. So really in this talk, I have two objectives, two ideas I want to leave you with. The first is the idea that perhaps what quantum theory is telling us about the world is that there's a fundamental limitation on how much we can know about the physical states of the systems around us. So this is not a new idea, and in fact, when you say something's not a new idea, sometimes you mean, oh, it's, you know, from the 60s, or it's, you know, from the 20s, you know. This is an idea that goes back to the ancient Greeks, okay? So if you look in Plato's Dialogues, and you look at the Republic, you'll find a discussion called the Allegory of the Cave, Plato's Allegory of the Cave. And so Socrates describes this situation. He says, imagine some prisoners who are trapped in a cave, and they've been there their entire lives, and they're forced to look only forward at a wall in front of them. And all they can see on that wall are the shadows of objects which are behind them. There's a light source up and behind them, and it's casting shadows all the time, and all they see are the shadows for their whole lives. And so Socrates says, isn't it reasonable to expect that these prisoners will come to think that the shadows are the reality? It's all they've ever known. And Socrates says, we are like those prisoners. We see things around us, we think they're real, but in fact, we're just seeing shadows. We're seeing just aspects of a deeper reality. And so I want to argue that in a very quantitative, meaningful way, quantum theory perhaps is such a theory, that we, because of quantum theory, are like the prisoners in the cave, limited in how much we can know about reality, only seeing certain aspects. The second idea that I want to tell you about has to do with correlations between systems. So the question is, how do we explain correlations between distant systems? And so there's a really nice theorem by John Bell that I'm going to end up telling you about at the end of the talk. And it's explained very well. John Bell used this example of the way that we normally explain correlations. And that's in terms of, well, here's the example. It's Bertelmann socks. So Dr. Bertelmann was a colleague of Bell's. And he was notorious for always wearing different colored socks. So if you saw Dr. Bertelmann coming around the corner and you saw that one of his socks was pink, then you knew that the other sock was not pink. And so the point is that if you ask, well, you know, what causes the other sock to not be pink? Is it my observation of the first sock being pink that causes it not to be pink? Well, that seems kind of ludicrous. No, all that changes about the other sock is my knowledge of it. So when I update my knowledge about this sock, and I find out it's pink, then I find out that the other sock is not pink. But it was not pink all along. You know, the reason the two socks were different colors was ultimately because of a decision that Dr. Bertelmann made in the morning at the sock drawer to, you know, maintain his reputation as somebody who always wears different colored socks. So what Bell discovered was that quantum correlations cannot be explained in this kind of way, which is very surprising. Okay, so I'm going to have to start by telling you about a little bit about quantum theory. So quantum theory was invented at the turn of the 20th century. Started with some work by Planck, and then, so all these people are in this photo. There's Planck, Einstein worked on the photoelectric effect, Niels Bohr did important work. It culminated in the mid-20s with the work of Schrodinger and Heisenberg, where we really got the theory in the form that we have it today. And initially, the theory showed that certain variables that classically we know to be continuous, to take on arbitrary values, were found to only take on discrete values, so things like the energy of a system. Another example would be the angular momentum of a system. And so there's a famous experiment from 1922 that shows this quantization of angular momentum. And so I'm just going to take you through it. So on the, let's see, that would be our your left, my right, we have an oven that emits silver atoms. And we have them in a very collimated beam, and then we pass them through this funny-shaped magnet. And the idea is that this funny-shaped magnet creates a non-uniform magnetic field, and all of the atoms are like little magnets themselves. And they're going to be deflected by this magnetic field by an amount that depends on the how much strength that little magnet has along the direction defined by the big magnets. Okay, so if you're in a classical world, you expect that it could have any deflection at all. And so you'd expect this uniform spread of possibilities. But what Stern and Gerlach found was that it only gets deflected by one of two angles. And that corresponds to the quantized angular momentum of those atoms. So they refer to this quality as the spin of a system. And it only takes these two values. They were so excited about this result that they sent Niels Bohr a postcard. That's, I guess, how things worked in these days. You send postcards announcing your great results. And so on the right, you see this lip, which shows the separation of the two lines that they saw on the photographic plate corresponding to the quantization. So what I'd like to talk about is a more modern version of this experiment, wherein instead of having a continuous beam of atoms, what you have is, yes?
That feels much better. Yeah.
This probably feels much better for you, too. Yeah, I told them I was loud, but oh well. So where was I? Right, I was talking about the more modern version of this experiment, where instead of a dense stream of these atoms, what you have are you attenuate the beam and you make sure that only a single atom is passing through the apparatus at any given time. And what you find in that case is that if you look for which beam it comes out, half the time you find it in the upper beam, and half the time you find it in the lower beam. And it's completely random where it ends up. You can also rotate that magnet, so now it's pointing along the x-axis rather than the z-axis, and you repeat the experiment, and you find the same results. Half the time it comes out on the down beam, half the time it comes out on the upward beam. Now, I'm going to want to look at what happens if you do sequences of these measurements. So a convenient thing to do is to take those two beams that come out and put them through some magnetic field such that they align again into a single beam. And so I haven't shown those magnets here, but you can do that. You can get them to align, and then you can pass that beam on to further measurements down the road. And because this is sort of a complicated little diagram here, I'm just going to simplify the whole thing so that it's easier. I'm going to put it all in a box, and I put a Z on the front of the box, meaning this is a Stern-Gerlach magnet that's oriented up in the Z direction. And you'll see that there's two little boxes on the front, which are little LED lights. And the way it works is that if on the inside you find the particle on the upward path, then there's some circuitry that makes sure that the top LED light comes on and it flashes green. And if you find the particle along the lower path, then the bottom LED light comes on and flashes red. So I'm going to represent the whole thing in this very simple way. You've got your oven, you press the button on top, it spits out an atom, and then you get some outcome. 50% of the time it's green, 50% of the time it's red. You can do the same thing with these measurements with the magnets along the x direction. Recombine the beams, put the whole thing in a box, label it x, and it's the same thing. You get the two outcomes. So I represent that like that. 50-50 statistics for that one. Okay, now we can start asking, what happens if I start putting these things together? So suppose I do a Z box followed by another Z box. And suppose I get the green outcome on the first one. That happens half the time. On the second one, I get the green result 100% of the time. So if I ever follow up a measurement by the same measurement, I find that the results are reproduced. If I get the red outcome in the first box, then I get the red outcome all the time on the second box. And it doesn't matter how many of these I put together, it always reproduces the same measurement outcome. Now, what if I do it with X boxes? So if I get the green outcome on the first X box, I also get the green outcome on the second, and similarly for the red. OK, now what if I do Z and then X? Well, it turns out I can't tell anything about an X measurement from a Z, from the result of a Z measurement. It's just 50-50 statistics. And it doesn't matter what the outcome was. And similarly, if I reverse X and Z. OK, now here's the interesting one. Suppose I do Z, and then X, and then Z. OK, so I press the button. I'll get some outcome. Maybe it's green. I'll get some outcome for X. Maybe it's red. And now the question is, what's going to happen on the next one? Now, if your intuition is that these boxes are measuring properties of the system, then what you've got is that so far you've measured the Z property and found it to be green, and you've measured the X property and found it to be red. And if you measure the Z property again, presumably you'll find it to be green. But the other intuition is that if we remove that first Z box, then we have a situation we've seen before where there's an X measurement followed by a Z measurement, and that gave me random outcomes for the Z measurement. So let me put it to you. What do you think is going to happen? How many think that I'll get 100% green on that final measurement? And how many people think it's going to be 50-50? Okay. Well, you can't just guess. You have to go and you do the experiment. The experiment's been done, and what you find is that it is 50-50. So it seems that these measurements aren't merely revealing properties of these systems, because the X measurement, or if they are, then the X measurement is randomizing the Z property, because it's not necessarily the same the second time you measure it. Okay, this is a version of Heisenberg's uncertainty principle. So typically you might hear about it in the context of position and momentum, but here I'm describing it in the context of X spin and Z spin, and it has the same basic idea. What it says is that you can't predict simultaneously what would be the outcome of an X measurement if you did it, and also what would be the outcome of a Z measurement if you did a Z measurement. And so this is an interesting fact. It tells you that you can do some interesting stuff. So for example, if if you, in cryptography, if you've got people who have Z measurements, you know, somebody does a Z measurement of a particle, puts it out into the world, and then gets it back and does another Z measurement, they can know if other people have done measurements to try to find out information. And as a result, you can build cryptographic schemes on this sort of thing. You can build counterfeit-proof money, that sort of stuff. So it's at the basis of quantum theory, the uncertainty principle. Now I want to tell you just a little bit about the formalism. So this is just a few slides where I need to introduce this one element of the formalism, which is very important. So what I'm going to do is open these boxes up again. And I have a new magnet, which is oriented not along Z or along X, but rather at 45 degrees. And so I pass my spins through that. I'll find they're either on the upward or the downward trajectory. And then I pass them through my Z magnet. And the question is, what are going to be the probabilities of coming up and down at the far end? So the way you represent it is, for that far measurement, you have a couple of arrows, the green and the red arrow. Those correspond to the two outcomes. And you make them at right angles to one another. And then the first preparation with the magnet that's oriented at 45 degrees is now represented by an arrow that's half that angle from the green axis, so 22.5 degrees. And then you just take the projection, meaning you drop perpendicular lines onto those two axes, the green and the red, and you square those quantities, which just means draw a square of that length. And the relative areas of those two squares tell you what the relative probabilities of the upward path and the downward path are. And you can also consider rotating that second magnet, and then you just rotate the green and the red axes by half the angle, and you do this procedure again, and it'll always tell you exactly what probabilities you should get. So that's the situation for this standard example I was showing you. You've done an X measurement, you've got the green outcome. So that corresponds to preparing a vector, that's the little yellow arrow, along the green axis. And then when you want to know what are the probabilities for the Z measurement, you just compare that yellow vector to the green and the red axes that are aligned in the Z axis. And you look at the projections, and they give 50-50 statistics, as we saw. Okay, so that's all the formulas I wanted to tell you about. This little yellow arrow is called by the Greek letter psi. Everybody denotes this as psi, and it's the central mathematical object of quantum theory. Everybody's talking about psi. This is the key tool. And it's amazing that despite being the key tool of this amazingly successful theory, we still don't really have an understanding. We don't have any agreement about how we should interpret it. So just a month ago here at the Perelman Institute, we had a conference entitled New Perspectives on the Quantum State. And this is the poster image for the conference. And the idea was to try to debate, you know, what this thing could possibly be. So one option was that this psi vector is just a catalog of all our expectations. So it just tells us this is, you know, what you think is going to happen. It allows us to make predictions. And that's all it does. It doesn't say anything about atoms. It's silent on the whole notion of atoms. It just makes predictions. Now, this is appealing to people who think that science is just about making predictions. But often we think it's more than that. If I had an oracle that would answer any question for me, it could make any predictions, I still wouldn't know what the interesting questions are. So often I'd prefer to think that science is about explanation and more than just prediction. Now, I want to focus on two other views. One, that the quantum state is a description of the real state of affairs for an individual system. And the other, that it's a description of our incomplete knowledge of the real state of affairs of an individual system. So let me give you an example of what that difference is. So suppose you go to Japan, and you don't speak Japanese, and you see this billboard that I've indicated here, and it's got some numbers on it, and every day these numbers change. And you're trying to figure out, what could this be? And so after a while, you realize, hey, I think that first number is a forecast for the temperature tomorrow. Because every time it says 18, the next day, the temperature is 18 degrees Celsius. And then eventually, the second one's a bit harder, but you realize it's the mean wind speed the next day. So it's the forecast for the wind speed. And then the third one, you're stumped. You go out and you measure properties the next day, everything you can think of, and nothing seems to have the value of that number. And so you think about it for a while, and then you try something different. You say, is there anything about the collection of days that followed a day where it said 0.5? Is there anything about that collection of days that's interesting? And what you find is that exactly half of them it rained. And you realize, hey, this number must be the probability of rain the next day. So it's not a description of any property of the following day, it's a description of a collection of days, or equivalently, your knowledge of, your incomplete knowledge of what's going to happen the next day. So representative of the first view, that the quantum state is a complete description of reality, is Niels Bohr. So here's a quote, quantum mechanical description of physical phenomena would seem to fulfill within its scope all rational demands of completeness. Okay, so what's the view? The view is just that this yellow arrow, psi, represents the system, the states of the system. So when I pass a system from one apparatus to the next, I describe it entirely just by this vector. And in particular, what that means is that because that vector only determines the probabilities for the two outcomes, it never says exactly which outcome will occur, only their probabilities, it means that nothing in the world, according to this view, determines those the outcomes, determines whether it's going to be green or red. It's objectively random. No fact in the world determines it, according to this view. So there's just extra information that's introduced in the world when a measurement's made. So Einstein didn't like that view. You may have heard this quote from him. He said, God does not play with dice. He preferred a view that was deterministic, where the past fixes what the state of the future is. But he had a more refined view on what the status of the central object of the theory was. He said, one conceives of the psi function only as an incomplete description of a real state of affairs, where the incompleteness of the description is forced by the fact that observation of the state is only able to grasp part of the real factual situation. So that sounds a lot like Plato's cave. We can only grasp part of the real factual situation. We can only see particular aspects of these three-dimensional shapes in the cave. So I want to tell you about a model. It's sort of a toy model which I developed. It represents the kind of interpretation of quantum mechanics that Einstein was looking for. So it'll give you a flavor for why quantum mechanics is amenable to this sort of interpretation. And so I'm going to be very literal with my analogy. Suppose every system, you can ask two questions about it. So you can think of that as a ball that's in a box that has four chambers. And you just want to know, you know, which of those chambers it's in. But the only ways you have of probing it are via shining lights on the sides of the box and looking at the shadows. So just like in Plato's cave. So if you shine the light from the side I've indicated here, then you see a shadow on the right-hand side. And you can't know from that whether the ball is in the front box or the back box on the right-hand side. So you know it's just one of those two. And the other measurement you do is shine the flashlight in the other direction. And there, you can't know. All you can find out is whether the ball is in one of those left two chambers or the right two chambers, and nothing more. So this is what we're imagining. We have systems that have four physical states, which I've drawn here, where the ball is in the four boxes. And we have two possible measurements, which divide those four states into two sets of two states. And so now we can start asking, well, how do we reproduce the statistics that I described to you earlier? Okay, well, the oven, first of all, we take to be something that samples an atom out of a set of atoms, and a quarter of those of the atoms have the state where the ball is in the first box, and a quarter of them have the state where the ball is in the second box, and so on. A Z box measurement just asks whether the state is on the ball is on the left or on the right. And so if you take one at random and you pass it through, you find you get the green outcome because it's on the left. And if you take another one, you find you get the red outcome because it's on the right. So if I do an X measurement, it's exactly the same, but this time I'm looking at whether it's on the bottom or on the top. And so now note that unlike that previous interpretation, here there is a matter of fact in the world that determines whether the outcome is green or red. It's where the ball is located. So the randomness here is not of the objective kind, it's of the subjective kind. The reason it appears random is because you don't know where the ball was when it came out of that oven. You can also explain the fact that you can repeat measurements and always get the same outcome. Because if you've done a Z measurement and you got the green outcome, Then you found out that that ball is on the left-hand side. And what you prepare now is a collection of systems, half of which have the ball on the bottom left, and half of which have the ball on the top left. And if you pass one of them along, no matter which one it is, it's always going to give you the green outcome again. And if I do a Z measurement and then an X measurement, half of them have it on the bottom, half of them have it on the top, and that's why I'm going to get my 50-50 statistics for the X measurement. And then finally, I can look at this sequence that describes Heisenberg's uncertainty principle. So what's your first guess as to what might happen? Well, you might think, come along, you measure whether it's left or right, then you measure whether it's bottom or top, then you measure whether it's left or right. But that would imply that that second Z measurement always gave the same outcome as the first one. And we know that doesn't happen. So this sort of theory couldn't possibly reproduce the predictions. For a while, Einstein entertained the possibility that the uncertainty principle might actually fail. And he tried to come up with clever schemes for showing how it might fail. And Niels Bohr always showed what was wrong with his schemes. So eventually, Einstein came around to the view that, no, the uncertainty principle is real. And so how can you fix this picture of hidden variables, so there's these things that are unknown, such that it can account for this? Well, it's very easy. What you do is you imagine that as a result of doing a measurement of Z, you necessarily randomize X. So I haven't illustrated here, but you can imagine that that ball might be bounced up and down along the between the front and the back. So the X value could be randomized. And when it gets passed on and the X is measured, it could be bounced around left to right, which would randomize its Z value. And if it got bounced to the right, then a subsequent measurement of Z would find the red outcome. Now, you might think, well, isn't that assuming objective indeterminism again? Well, not necessarily. Because what Bohr again pointed out is that any measurement on the system necessarily involves an interaction with some degrees of freedom, some variables in the apparatus. And if we want to be consistent in our principle that the uncertainty principle applies to everything, then those apparatus atoms also have an uncertainty principle applying to them. So there's things we don't know about them. And when they interact with my system of interest, that uncertainty about the apparatus infects the system of interest. And so what you can have in these sorts of models is that it is determined how the X value is changed under a Z measurement, and what determines it are variables in the apparatus that you just don't know. So it's, again, subjective indeterminism. Okay, so Bohr wasn't convinced by Einstein's argument for hidden variables. Why is that? What was his problem? And if you read his papers, often he speaks as if he believes in hidden variables. He talks about the position and the momentum and our knowledge of them. And yet, in this quote, for example, he says, quantum phenomena do not merely have to do with an ignorance of the value of certain physical quantities, but with the impossibility of defining these quantities in an unambiguous way. So what's going on? Well, my reading of it is that Bohr is really heavily influenced by his philosophical predispositions. Bohr was a positivist. So positivism was a movement in philosophy in the early 20th century. What they were trying to do was to understand how it can be, how you demarcate scientific questions from unscientific questions. And so what they came up with was that if a proposition is such that it can be verified experimentally, then it's meaningful. And if not, then it's not meaningful. And so Bohr basically said, look, if you have two quantities and they can't be jointly measured, then that implies that you can't jointly define them according to this positivist criteria. Whereas Einstein would just say the impossibility of jointly measuring these two quantities implies the impossibility of jointly knowing them. That's more like Plato's cave, where you can have just knowledge of one shadow or another, but not both simultaneously. So my sense is that people don't really believe in positivism anymore, but there's a modern sentiment which parallels Bohr's sentiment, which is the idea that if something's hidden and you can never come to know it, then what's the point of postulating it? What good does it do you? It's just metaphysics. And so to respond to that, I'm going to go back to the cave and give you an analogy. So imagine you have a prisoner in the cave. He sees these shadows. And he develops a theory. He says, you know, these shadows have a lot in common. I postulate that there's something called the third dimension. And there's these objects, and they have something called three-dimensional shape. And these things we see are just different aspects of that three-dimensional shape. So there's something hidden, the three-dimensional shape. You can only know certain things about it at any given time. I would say that person is doing good science. But somebody else, another prisoner, who said, oh, I think there's another hidden variable, and that's color. These 3D objects have color. And the color is absolutely irrelevant to the shadows we see. That's bad science. You're introducing something that's hidden, and it makes no difference at all. Whereas the first person was introducing something that had explanatory power. So I think Bohr's criticisms perhaps are good criticisms of color-like hidden variables, but not necessarily of shape-like hidden variables. All right, so I'm going to move on now to Einstein's second argument in favor of his view of quantum theory. And now we're going to start touching upon the nature of correlations between distant systems. So this discussion actually took place at that Solvay conference in 1927. Einstein did not give a talk, but he did comment in the general discussion at the Solvay conference. And we now have a nice English translation of the Solvay conference that just came out recently, which you can pick up in bookstores by Bacigalupi and Valentini. And you can read that the third commenter was Einstein, and he starts off very humbly. He says, despite being conscious of the fact that I have not entered deeply enough into the essence of quantum mechanics, nevertheless, I want to present here some general remarks. And then he goes on and presents his argument. And here's what it is. He imagines a new kind of preparation for now not a single atom, but pairs of atoms. It's a preparation which people call entangled. So this pair of atoms entangled. I won't tell you the details of how they get prepared. All that's important is how they behave. So suppose you take these two atoms, you bring them to distant locations, and you do a Z measurement on each of them. What you find is that if you get the green outcome on one, you also get the green outcome on the other. And that happens 50% of the time. And the other 50% of the time, you get the red outcome on both of them. So you never get the red and the green or the green and the red. And there's a very easy way of explaining this, a very simple model. It's just like Bertelmann's socks. You say, look, there must be some property in the atom that determines whether the outcome is going to be green or red. And it's just that those two atoms have properties that are correlated. And so they either both return red results or they both return green results. And when I find out that on one side I've got the red outcome, that doesn't change anything about the atoms on the other side. I just update my knowledge of that property. I find out it must be the property that corresponds to the red outcome. But this is very different from the picture that Bohr or Heisenberg would have, anybody who thought that quantum state was a complete description, because there you say, no, there is no property of the system that determines whether it's a green or a red outcome. That's completely random. Even if you tell me the psi vector, I still can't tell you whether it's going to be the green or red outcome. So now you have a problem. You can imagine that that these two outcomes occur independently, and they're just random. But in that case, it's like two independent coin flips. And sometimes you'll get green, red. And we know that that doesn't happen. So instead, what you have to say is that when you measure on one side and you get a particular outcome, say green, that must cause the other side, that must tell the other side, you can't respond red now. You have to respond green now that this has happened. You have to enforce these correlations. So there has to be some kind of non-local or an action from one side to the other, even though these two measurements might be taking place far apart from one another at exactly the same time. You'd have to have this kind of action happening. Einstein referred to this as spooky action at a distance. He thought it was unreasonable to assume this, in particular because it seemed to be at odds with his theory of relativity. So now you might ask, well, what did Bohr say? And the truth is that it seems Bohr missed the point. Some evidence is that Bohr, right after this, said, I think I don't understand what precisely is the point which Einstein wants to make. And I think Bohr was a very clever guy. Ultimately, they were really talking past one another because they had very different philosophical presuppositions. So that's how it stood in 1927. The debate raged on for years afterwards. This didn't die down. Bohr and Einstein had many more conversations about this. It culminated in 1935. Einstein wrote a paper with two co-authors, Podolsky and Rosen, which basically presented a version of his 1927 argument, a little bit refined, slightly different, but improved. Title of the paper was, Can Quantum Mechanical Description of Physical Reality Be Considered Complete? The implicit answer, no. Bohr responded with a paper with the title, Can Quantum Mechanical Description of Reality Be Considered Complete? Implicit answer, yes. And if you take a look at these papers, my sense is that the paper, Einstein's paper, is really quite clear and pretty compelling. Bohr's paper has some deep insights in it, but in the key places where he's responding to the Einstein-Podolsky-Rosen argument, it's very cryptic, and it's not easy to really extract what Bohr is trying to say. And to drive that point home, I'll just tell you a little story. You know, you read Bohr and you think, you know, what's he trying to say? He's using these long sentences, there's all this prose. You don't really know where he's going. The narrative is a bit confusing. When they reprinted this paper in a collection of papers edited by Wheeler and Zurich, they got two of the pages out of order, and nobody noticed. It read just as well as the original version. So 30 years went by. I should say, to be fair, although I think nobody really provided a proper response to Einstein's argument, it is true that other people, other scientists, were providing attacks on the general idea of a hidden variable approach to quantum theory. So they weren't specifically attacking this argument of Einstein's, but they were saying that, you know, there's challenges with this sort of approach, and Einstein himself worked very hard to develop this kind of theory and consistently failed to do it. But the question of, you know, whether correlations can be explained in a common cause kind of way, in the Bertelmann-Sox sort of way, was reconsidered by John Stuart Bell in 1964. So John Bell was an Irish physicist. He worked at CERN, which is the particle physics laboratory in Geneva. He was an accelerator physicist. He worked on accelerator design, theoretical particle physics, and in his spare time, he worked on the foundations of quantum mechanics. And he devoted about, he says, 10% of his time on foundational questions, which is really a shame, because if you look at his paper, they're incredibly incisive. It's so deep. Everything he says is very precise, very witty, very concise. They're really a pleasure. And so it's unfortunate that he didn't spend more time. And it's also unfortunate that he died unexpectedly in 1990 of a heart attack. But fortunately, it was not before he was able to see his predictions verified experimentally. So he made some predictions about correlations that cannot be explained in a common cause sort of fashion in quantum mechanics. He basically became a bit of a hero in the field of quantum foundations for this result. I think he's a bit of a hero still today. So what did he show? Well, remember, Einstein, 1927, showed that if quantum theory provides a complete description of reality, then one cannot explain correlations in terms of local actions. Okay, but Einstein was hoping that if it is an incomplete description of reality, then one can. That's what he was holding out for. But Bell in 1964 showed that hope was shattered. Even if quantum theory provides an incomplete description of reality, even if this picture of Plato's cave and us only knowing some of the information is correct, you still can't explain all the quantum correlations in terms of local actions, common causes, Bertelmann-Sock type approach. Okay, so it's a bit harder to explain to you how Bell's theorem works, but I'm gonna do it. I'm gonna try to, so that you can leave this room saying, I know Bell's theorem and I understand it. So we're gonna again use entangled pairs of particles. I'm not gonna tell you how those are prepared. We're also gonna use measurements which are different from the ones I told you about before. Right, so before I had Z and X measurements, and I'm not gonna use those anymore. So forget everything I told you about Z measurements and how they worked. That's not gonna be relevant here. I have two new measurements, and I'm just gonna give them names, S and T. It's not important what they are. It's important how they're gonna behave. And what Bell imagined was these two entangled particles are going to be subjected to one of two measurements, S or T, when they get to the two ends. And the decision of which it's gonna be will be determined by a coin flip. So if the coin comes up heads, then it's S over on the left-hand side. And if the coin comes up tails, then it's going to be T. And the same thing for the right-hand side. If the coin comes up heads, it's S. And if it comes up tails, it's T. And so there's only four possibilities for the measurements that could be done. Either they're both S, they're S and T, they're T and S, or they're T and T. That's it. Those are the four possibilities. OK, and now you're wondering, well, what are the correlations? You know, what are the patterns of outcomes corresponding to that? And I'm not just going to tell you. I'm going to lead up to it. And to do it, I'm going to play a game. So I think it's going to make it more fun and easier to understand. And I've selected four assistants to help me with the game. So let me ask them to come up to the stage now and give me a hand. So we have here Sue and Jill. They're festival volunteers. They've been working hard all week, doing an amazing job at the festival, as have all the volunteers. So let's start by giving them a big round of applause. So we can go here. And here we have Ingrid and Steve. So the way this is going to work is that Ingrid and Steve are going to represent the particles. Okay, so they're going to be playing the role of the particles in this experiment. And Jill and Sue are going to be the measurement devices. OK, so I'm going to give Jill and Sue each a Canadian loonie, which they can use as their coin flip. Here you go. And you need a card. I'll give you two of those and a pen. There. Here's your coin. There we are. OK. And the way things are going to work is that I'm going to tell Steve and Ingrid exactly what correlations they have to generate. And then we're going to play it out. We're going to see if they can do it. So here's the first challenge for Steve and Ingrid. So they want to prepare answers, right? So what's going to happen is they're both, eventually, when I tell them to go, they're going to go over to the measurement devices. The measurement devices are going to flip a coin to decide whether it's S or T that's being measured. And they're going to give an answer, either green or red. And so they have to come prepared with these answers. They have to know, what am I going to answer if I get asked S? What am I going to answer if I get asked T? And they have to satisfy the following rules to win. Whenever it so happens that they get asked the same question, so the same measurement is made on them, then their outcomes have to agree. So if they answer, if one of them answers green, then the other one has to answer green as well. And if they get asked different questions, so different measurements are made on the two sides, then their answers have to disagree. So it's very simple. They need to think of a strategy ahead of a time to make sure that they can always do this. Pretty clear? All right, let's see it worked out. So why don't you work on your strategy, take a moment. While they're taking a moment to work on the strategy, I want you all to think, is there a way in which you could win this game all the time? So they're going to go off, and they're going to have written down on a piece of paper what the questions are, and they're going to write their answers, and we're going to see if they can do it. Are you guys ready? All right, go for it. Particles to your measurement stations. All right, we have the coins being flipped simultaneously. It's very important in this game that Ingrid doesn't see what question is being asked over here, and Steven can't see what question is being asked over here. And that's why we're writing it and confining it to these pieces of paper. And then we're going to have Ingrid write her answer on the piece of paper. And Steven, you're going to write your answer on the piece of paper. And we're going to see how they do. Are you ready? OK. We have the data coming in. All right. I love being an experimentalist. OK, so it turns out that the coins were flipped. And Steven was asked the S question, and he answered green. And Ingrid was also asked the S question, and she answered green. The rule was, if they were asked the same measurement, then their outcomes should agree. And their outcomes do agree. So they win the game. Let's congratulate them. Well done. OK, now I'm just going to take a moment to explain how you could win this game all the time. So I don't know exactly what strategy they used, but there is a strategy that allows you to win all the time. And here it is. I should mention that this is not the form of Bell's theorem that was originally presented by Bell. This is called the non-local box game. It was originally introduced by Popescu and Rohrlich. So here's the correlations they need to achieve. They need to give a green red answer for each of these four boxes, right? S or T for Ingrid, S or T for Stephen. And their colors that they assign have to be such that on the top and on the bottom they agree, and across the diagonals they disagree. So an obvious strategy is the following. They both agree, if we're asked S, we'll answer green. And if we're asked T, we'll answer red. And then they agree when they're both asked S, they agree when they're both asked T, and they disagree along the diagonals. So they win the game all the time, no matter which of these four questions are asked. Okay, we're going to move on to the second game, if you're ready. So here's challenge number two. The rules are very similar, but not quite the same. Here, whenever the same measurement is made on the particles, the outcomes must always disagree. And whenever different measurements are made on the particles, the answers must always agree. Clear? All right, so take a moment to confer what your strategy is going to be. And you, the audience, should again ask yourselves, how would you win this game 100% of the time? You ready? Okay, let's do it. Oh, coin flipping. It's when you do this in the lab, it's less high tech than this. All right, let's see what we've got. Okay, thank you very much. Okay, so it turns out that the coin flips came up much like they did last time. On the right, the coins came up with S, and the answer was green. On the left, the question came up as S, and the answer was red. And the rules say that if the same measurement is made on the particles, the outcomes must disagree, and they do. So they've won the game again. Let's thank them very much, and let's thank all of my assistants. You can have a thank you very much. I must make sure to collect my money. Okay, so let's ask the same question. How would we win this game 100% of the time? So it's very similar. Well, here's the new pattern. You have to be such that if you both get asked S, you disagree, and along the diagonals you agree. So all you have to do is Ingrid has to answer green for the S question, red for the T question, and Stephen has to do the opposite, and then they always win. Very simple. Okay, so all these correlations I've just told you about can be explained in terms of common causes. It's like Bertelmann's socks, no problem. Now let's consider the real kicker. This is the Bell theorem challenge. So here, the rule is the following. Whenever the measurement T is made on both the particles, the outcomes have to disagree. Otherwise, so if the two measurements are SS, ST, or TS, the outcomes have to agree. So this is the pattern. We have to have agreement across the top and along the diagonals, but along the bottom, we have to have disagreement. Now, if you take a moment, you might realize that there's a problem with this. Let me take you through it. Okay, so suppose Ingrid, suppose we were playing this game. I chose not to play this game because it's not guaranteed that you're going to win, and that's always a little bit embarrassing if somebody loses. So Ingrid could choose to answer green for the T question. Okay, so let's put that down. But if that's their strategy, then Stephen would have to answer green for the S question. And then, because of that diagonal that demands agreement. But then Ingrid would have to answer green for the S question as well. And that, by virtue of the other diagonal, so that implication is by virtue of the thing on top, the other diagonal tells you that Stephen has to answer green for the T question. Now we have a problem, because they're supposed to disagree when they both get asked T, but this strategy has them agreeing. So they haven't satisfied that rule. And this happens no matter what strategy they adopt. If Ingrid had decided to answer red for the T question, I would have had the same set of inferences with red, and we would have, again, had agreement with the T question, not disagreement. So it's easy to see that the best you could possibly do in this game is to win 3/4 of the time, but not 100% of the time. Okay, so that's pretty clear. Here's the crazy thing. Entangled quantum systems somehow manage to win the game about 85% of the time. So if Stephen and Ingrid had quantum particles at their disposal and quantum measurement devices on them, which they didn't, but if they did, then they could have used those particles and those devices to provide answers, and they could have actually won the game 85% of the time. Now suppose that had happened, suppose I'd done that, you know, my contacts at University of Waterloo made it so, what would you say? How did they do that? Somehow, they must be cheating. those quantum particles must be cheating somehow. How could they cheat? One option would be if somehow Stephen and Ingrid had a system where they would signal to one another what question was being asked on their side, right? So if Ingrid had, you know, some like an ear thing, I don't know exactly, but a signal to say, that's the S question for me, and Stephen glanced over and said, right, S question, I'm gonna respond appropriately, then they could win. And here's how it would work. So look over here, oops. The T question on Stephen's side, he could answer green or red, depending on what was asked of Ingrid on the left-hand side. He would have to know what was asked of Ingrid, so some communication would have to happen. Ingrid would have to tell him. But then he could answer green if Ingrid was being measured along S, and red if she was being measured along T. And in that way, they would satisfy the correlations of the game. But there's a problem. I mean, that's a great cheating strategy. Works really well. But there's a problem, which is this. Einstein's theory of relativity tells us that there's a speed limit in nature, that signals can only propagate so fast, the speed of light in particular. So suppose I set up the game such that Stephen and Ingrid are very, very far apart in space, and it's timed so that the time between the coin flip and when they have to provide their answer is very short. And so even if Ingrid sends a signal immediately after the coin flip comes out off to Stephen, he doesn't get the signal before he actually has to reply. So he can't have the benefit of knowing that because of relativity. So clearly you think, well, if you really did the experiment that way, then surely it could come out only to be 75%. There's no way that you could get this 85% probability. So you can go and you can do the experiment. And amazingly, quantum theory is corroborated. You do get 85%. Very strange. How's this working? We could say, well, maybe what we've discovered is that somehow relativity is deeply wrong. It's deeply wrong, and in fact, we can use these entangled quantum particles to send messages faster than the speed of light. No, we can't. We can't do that. Let me explain why not. So suppose that you had some particles. These are not quantum particles, they're better. Which always win this game 100% of the time. And suppose, furthermore, the way they do it is by always answering with this particular pattern. Green everywhere, except red for the T on the right. Then you could use these particles to signal. The way you would do it is that Ingrid could choose S or T to encode her bit of information, the 0 or 1. Say they're using Morse code or something. And then Stephen always measures T, and he just registers whether it's green or red, and that tells him what Ingrid was trying to send. So they could use this. But suppose instead that instead of always answering with this pattern, the particles only half the time answered with this pattern, and half the time answered with the opposite pattern, all red, but one green. Now there would be a problem, because when Stephen got the T green outcome, he wouldn't know whether over here, Ingrid had measured T and gotten the red outcome, or perhaps she had measured S and gotten the green outcome. He can't tell the difference between the two. And the point is that Ingrid can control what she measures, S or T, but she can't control what outcomes she gets. That's not in her power. And so they can't use these correlations to send signals. So it's very mysterious. So here's what we've got. If there's to be a causal explanation of the correlations that we've seen, then to do better than 75%, there has to be some sort of causal influence that propagates faster than light. But we also know that these influences can't be used to signal. That is very strange that these two things should be true. It seems almost conspiratorial. If you can send influences faster than light, why can't you use them to signal? Why not? There ought to be some deep reason. And the truth is, so far, we don't really know. This is an open problem. We don't, in my mind, nobody has provided a good fundamental understanding of why we have this juxtaposition of two facts, how these things make sense together. To wrap up, Bell's theorem doesn't tell us that this Plato's cave picture of the world that Einstein was looking for is wrong. It doesn't tell us that. It doesn't say we have to go back to the view that the quantum state describes everything, because we know that that view also had this, wasn't able to explain correlations with common causes. We knew that in 1927. Einstein showed that. We had to wait till 1964 to find out that Plato's cave type view also can't explain the correlations in terms of local actions. And so really this whole locality business turns out not to be decisive on that question of the debate between Bohr and Einstein. But it's a fascinating fact, and we'd like to understand it. So I'll end by noting that what Bell's theorem does is it shows that there's a kind of tension between our best theory of most of physics, excluding gravitation, namely quantum theory, and our theory of gravitation, on the other hand, general relativity. There's a kind of tension, because you might take relativity to say you can't send signals faster than the speed of light, therefore there's no real conflict. But a lot of people would say, well, maybe relativity says more than that. Maybe it says something about causal influences. In any case, it seems uncomfortable. General relativity is about causes, and there's something strange going on with causation in quantum mechanics. So there's a tension between these two pillars of modern physics. And I think it's appropriate for this festival, because these are the quantum and the cosmos. So Bell's theorem reveals a tension between the quantum and the cosmos, and on that note, I think I'll end. Thank you very much for your attention.
Okay, thank you, Rob. So now we have time for questions. So if you have a question, come down this aisle and stand in front of the microphone. Remember that to stand close to the microphone so we can hear you. First question, I guess, comes from over the internet, Jen Dodd.
Yes, the first question from our online audience is Phil from Toronto. He'd like to know, do you think that this pursuit of a deeper theory of nature is a bit premature before we have a better grip on what the implications of quantum mechanics are?
The pursuit of a deeper theory of nature, premature. Well, I think the two things go hand in hand. So personally, in my own research, I do mostly foundations of quantum mechanics, but I also do some quantum information theory. And my philosophy is that when you ask, what are the consequences of this quantum theory? One question you can ask, what are the applications of it? That might not seem like a very foundational question, but in fact, by working out those problems, you can often get insight into, what the principles that underlie a theory are. So the flip side is that as you try to understand a theory more deeply, you also get insights into what sorts of applications you might have. So in my mind, it's not that one comes before the other, but you should really pursue both those objectives simultaneously.
I have a second question from online. Tatiana from Toronto asks, what kind of new, contradictory, unexpected measurement of reality could challenge our current quantum model of reality? Which conditions could help make this happen?
So one example is a result by Antony Valentini. So he is somebody who believes in the hidden variable program. And he thinks that quantum theory is an equilibrium theory. So it's just sort of one particular instance among a set of theories, more general theories being non-equilibrium. And in particular, he sees the no signaling constraint of relativity as a specific aspect of the equilibrium state. And so he predicts that for exotic kinds of matter, maybe near black holes, maybe from cosmological sources, you might be able to find something that you could then use to superluminally signal. And if you discovered that, then certainly you'd realize that quantum theory as we know it now is wrong.
Thank you.
Hi, I'm Barry Silverman from Toronto. Has anybody in the past invented a hidden variable theory that didn't assume local actions, or is anybody working on that now?
Yes, in fact, all of the ones that are still contenders for actually being a description of quantum mechanics must involve non-local actions because they need to reproduce the predictions of Bell's theorem. And in fact, we had such a theory early on. So de Broglie in the 20s developed a theory of hidden variables, and David Bohm in the 50s rediscovered de Broglie's theory. And it was actually by looking at those theories that Bell came up with his theorem, because he was studying Bohm's theory and he realized, hey, this theory has these funny non-local actions. I wonder if every hidden variable theory has to have these things. And that's how he came upon his theorem. So yes, if you want hidden variables, then you can have them in the form of these theories. Personally, I'm not particularly happy with those theories because for me, all the analogies I showed you, or all the phenomena I showed you, it was very critical that the quantum state was represented by an ensemble of possibilities, a collection of possibilities. The quantum state really represented just incomplete knowledge. And two different quantum states corresponded to two states of knowledge that might be consistent with a single reality. Whereas all the hidden variable theories that we currently have, any two quantum states are not consistent with the same reality. And that's a feature that I'm not happy with, and so I'd prefer something quite different.
Hi, I'm back again. We have a very voluble online audience for this. Zhang asks, what things can travel faster than C?
What things can travel? Well, strangely, but topically for this talk, shadows. Shadows can travel faster than the speed of light. You just have to set things up in such a way that you have an object that's moving subluminally. In everyday experience, you can find that shadows will move faster than the objects. So to some extent, you have to define, what is a thing? What are the things that can't travel faster than the speed of light? And the standard view, I would say, is that it's information that relativity imposes a limit on. But John Bell made a very interesting point in one of his papers. He said, if the content of special relativity is that information and signals can't travel faster than the speed of light, then we have to have a way of describing precisely what it is to send a signal. We have to have a description of what it is to be an observer and what it is to send signals, and that's not really part of our fundamental theory if we're starting in terms of describing things in atoms. So from the perspective that we want to describe everything from the bottom up, Bell says it's much more reasonable to say that relativity is about restricting causal influences. They should not be able to travel faster than the speed of light. So Bell actually argued that his theorem showed that there was a conflict between relativity and quantum mechanics.
One more, mm-hmm. if you will. Antti from Finland asks, how could we use entangled particles in quantum computers?
Well, there's several results now that show that certain kinds of entanglement are necessary for getting a quantum speed up. But our honorable chairperson has shown that you can have lots of entanglement and still have no advantage over classical computation. So we have an idea of what kinds of entanglement we need. The issue is not completely settled. But my sense is the kind of answer I would like is, what is the physical principles that underlie quantum computation? So what is the innovation that quantum theory represents relative to classical theories? Is it non-locality, for example? Is that the fundamental principle that powers quantum computation? It would be nice to know.
Thank you.
I was just wondering if dark energy or dark matter could be the mechanism for this communication between the two items. Because there's I don't think anybody has defined whether there's a speed limit on dark energy or dark matter. So if there's no speed limit on those, could they actually be the mechanism for the communication between the two entangled particles?
It's a good question. As with all these things, the question I always ask back if somebody proposes a candidate mechanism, they say, here, this thing will travel faster than light, and it will do what needs to be done to ensure the Bell violation. And I always come back with, right, but what ensures that you can't use those things to signal? What's the principle that says these really fast things can now not be used by us? So if you say, well, it's dark matter, possibly, but the question would then be, what is the special property of it that prohibits us from then using that to actually send messages?
Okay, I can see our audience is deeply engrossed in pondering the mysteries of quantum mechanics, so maybe that's time to end the question session. Before we leave you, though, some reminders. The next event is a lecture called Creating Space-Time by Fotini Markopoulou, a physicist at Perimeter Institute, and that lecture will begin at 4 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time. Don't forget to check out all the other Q2C events by going to q2cfestival.com. Thank you to those of you attending here at Perimeter Institute in Waterloo, Ontario, Canada. Thank you also to those watching online. This presentation will be available on demand, so please share the festival website link with others who will be interested. The chapter's bookstore is open at the back of the atrium with a selection of books on the festival themes. And now, please join me in thanking Rob one more time.